This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
U.S.-Israeli genocidal war in Gaza continues for 169th day, with occupation forces intensifying the attacks on Al-Shifa Hospital. Hamas hails Russia and China for vetoing a U.S. draft resolution on Gaza, saying Washington wanted to give legitimacy to Israeli genocide against Palestinians. And the death toll from a terror attack near Moscow rises to well over 100, with Russia hinting about Ukraine's involvement in the attack. Nearly 6 months into Israel's genocidal war on Gaza and the regime's unrelenting bombing and shelling continue to claim more Palestinian lives. At least 10 people were killed in an Israeli airstrike on Gaza City, and a home was struck in the southern city of Rafah, where 8 people, mostly women and children, lost their lives. And 3 more Palestinians were killed in an airstrike in Khan Yunis, also in the south. The regime began this war on Gaza back on the 7th of October, and since then, more than 32,000 people have been killed, most of them women and children. Over 7,000 others are still unaccounted for and presumed dead and buried under rubble, and another 74,500 have been injured. And joining us earlier from the besieged enclave is our Moti Abu Musabe for an update.
Continuous as Israeli aggression against Al-Shifa Square enters its sixth consecutive day with continuous attacks with fierce airstrikes and artillery shelling and gunfire of the Israeli tanks. Several buildings inside the Al-Shifa compound were targeted heavily by the Israeli bombardments and the Israeli shelling, leaving multiple buildings on fire over that intensive attacks. In the meantime, the Palestinian residents who are still stranded and who are still besieged inside the hospital actually are living catastrophic humanitarian conditions. They are trapped between the continuous Israeli attacks and the lack of the basic humanitarian needs, as the Israeli occupation forces are still denying them any entry of their basic humanitarian necessities. The surrounding areas also were targeted heavily by the Israeli attacks and the Israeli airstrikes. Several residential buildings were destroyed, in addition to the people who were killed over those chronic attacks against the residential apartments in the vicinity of the Al-Shifa medical complex. Multiple appeals were released by those families and those Palestinian civilians in that area for the international human rights organizations to help them to be evacuated and to rescue them from this continuous Israeli attack that is targeting them continuously. When it comes to the central area of Gaza Strip, the Israeli warplanes carried out relentless and cruel Israeli airstrikes against Al-Amal town, located in the northern part of Al-Nusayrat refugee camp. It includes several residential towers. The Israeli occupation forces flattened and leveled to the ground several residential towers in that area, leaving thousands of the Palestinian civilians home.
The United Nations top aid official in occupied Palestinian territory says that more supplies and more fuel are needed to make sure the Gaza hospitals can operate.
I've just been inside the Kamal Adwan Hospital. I met with Dr. Usman and his team, and we took a tour of the hospital. We see ourselves what was there, and they're really struggling to provide the services required for the patients coming in, especially children. But there's also a lot of trauma patients coming in, many coming in from the food distributions where there's been a lot of injuries. And then also, because of what's happening in Shifa, many people are coming from Shifa here, and it's overwhelming the hospital. So we have to get more support, more supplies, and more fuel in to make sure the hospital keeps running.
Now, this comes as head of the World Health Organization describes conditions inside the besieged Al-Shifa Hospital in central Gaza as utterly inhumane. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says no basic medical supplies, no dressings for wounds, and no medicine is available at the hospital. According to WHO chief, 50 health workers and 143 patients have been trapped in one of Al-Shifa's buildings since the second day of the raid, with extremely limited water and food. And ongoing Israeli strikes in the vicinity of the hospital are making it impossible for patients to receive the care they need. A Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, says over 100 people have so far been killed in an Israeli raid on Al-Shifa. The UN Security Council has rejected a U.S. draft resolution which linked a ceasefire in Gaza to the release of captives by Hamas. 11 Security Council members backed the resolution. However, permanent members Russia and China, as well as rotating member Algeria, voted against it, while one country abstained. Hamas welcomed rejection of the U.S. draft resolution. It said it would have given Israel cover and legitimacy for what it called the war of extermination against Palestinians. A Palestinian envoy to the UN called the resolution one-sided. Riyad Mansour expressed support for another draft resolution put forward by elected members of the Security Council, expected to be voted on soon. The Russian and Chinese representatives also said the U.S. resolution is imbalanced and does not clearly call for a ceasefire in Gaza.
Distinguished colleagues, from the very onset, it was clear that the so-called negotiations which our U.S. colleagues have been engaged in on this issue have been focused merely to drag out the time. All of our comments, all of our red lines were time and time disregarded, as were the proposals of a number of other delegations. This was some kind of an empty rhetorical exercise rather than normal work document. The American product is exceedingly politicized, the sole purpose of which is to help to play to the voters, to throw them a bone in the form of some kind of a mention of a ceasefire in Gaza, and to establish the U.S.'s political ambitions in the region through the establishment of terrorist labels, and to ensure the impunity of Israel, whose crimes in the draft are not even assessed. I wish to draw attention to the following. The U.S. draft contains an effective green light for Israel to mount a military operation in Rafah. At the very least, the authors try to make it such that nothing would prevent Western Jerusalem from continuing their brutal cleansing of the south of the Gaza Strip. And what is Washington actually trying to achieve? We have already stated that we will no longer tolerate pointless resolutions which do not contain a call for a ceasefire, which lead us to nowhere. This draft should not pass with the majority of the membership.
The death toll from Friday's terrorist attack on a concert hall near the Russian capital Moscow rises now to 115, while dozens more have sustained serious injuries. According to the Russian media, attackers dressed in camouflage outfits entered the Crocus City Hall and then opened fire there. The Daesh terrorist group has claimed responsibility, but authorities in Moscow have dismissed the assertion, emphasizing an investigation is still underway to ascertain the culprits. The Federal Security Service chief has reported the detention of 11 suspects. He says four of them directly involved in the attack were arrested in the Bryansk region bordering Ukraine following a car chase. Now, Ukraine, which is at war with Russia, had quickly denied any involvement. But head of the state for Duma has pointed his finger at Ukraine and his backers. Andrei Kartopolov says that Kiev will receive clear response on the battlefield if its involvement in this terrorist attack is confirmed. Joining us now is Tim Kirby, radio host and political analyst, for more on the story. Hey there, Tim. Welcome, and thanks for joining us with your thoughts on this. When you break it down, first of all, the U.S. supposedly 3.5 weeks ago gave Moscow some kind of lukewarm warning with not much involved, except that they believe there's going to be an imminent terrorist attack on Russian soil, possibly in the capital and possibly at a huge gathering, possibly a concert, and also they came out and said that they feel that it was the Daesh terrorists. I mean, the Daesh terrorists on a radio, on a Telegram post, said it was us. The U.S. came out within an hour and said, we believe they're right, and it is them, which is kind of odd. And then you have the Ukrainians quick to say that it wasn't us. Russians aren't buying that it was Daesh terrorists. Why not?
Well, why not for the reasons that you just stated, because a lot of this looks very suspicious. Like you mentioned with the mainstream media, how even before any information was revealed, the mainstream media was absolutely completely convinced that this was an ISIS or Daesh or whatever you want to call them style group, which they would have no means of knowing. You understand? And it's not just within the Russian public. This is pretty much globally. If you look at the alternative media, the English-speaking alternative media throughout the entire world, no one is buying this on that level. The only people who are buying this are certain people in Washington and the mainstream media. So, yeah, it's a pretty, let's just put it that way. And in this particular aspect, it's a pretty open and shut case.
And where do you see all roads leading and why?
Well, Russia is involved in what's essentially a proxy war between the United States deep state, as President Trump like to call it, and Russia, okay, via Ukraine. And so really, what would a radical Islamic Islamist group that also has a history of never attacking Washington's buddies, so this whole ISIS Daesh have never attacked Israel, they don't attack America, they only seem to, for some reason, for the most part, kill other Muslims in Syria. But anyways, that's a bit of a tangent. Essentially, well, who else really could it be? Who else is going to launch some sort of major terrorist attack on Russia? Wouldn't it be, if you know, if there's sort of the philosophy of, you know, whatever option seems the easiest or the most probable is maybe the one you should go with, at least initially, until evidence proves otherwise. And, you know, the country that or countries or entities that Russia's at war with are probably responsible for killing many Russians. You have to also understand that this isn't the only act of terrorism from the Russian standpoint. All the shellings of the Bryansk region and the Belgorod region are also considered to be terrorist attacks, because they, the Kiev side has shelled essentially markets and city streets and apartment buildings, which have no military value. So this is only the most recent and maybe most media-friendly, in quotes, terrorist attack in a long streak of anti-Russian terrorist attacks emanating from Kiev, which is obviously backed by certain factions in Washington.
Good stuff, bud. Thank you for joining us on the program, Tim. Stay safe. Pleasure to have you on. Tim Kirby there, radio host and political analyst, joining us from Moscow. Now, a funeral has been held for a Palestinian who succumbed to injuries he sustained over 8 months ago during an Israeli raid near the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Now, people gather to mourn the death of Amid Ghaleb Saeed Jaqoub in his hometown of Beita. He was shot in the head while regime forces were invading the town in August of last year. Now, reports suggest that Amid was hit as he was rushing to help a wounded Palestinian. His death brings to 12 number of Palestinians killed in the West Bank in the past 24 hours. Now, Israeli forces have conducted new raids on different cities since Friday, and that has resulted in the deaths of over four Palestinians in Jenin, four in Tukaram, one in Al-Khalil, one in Ramallah, and one in Ariha. Occupying forces intensified incursions into the occupied West Bank since early October, when the regime launched its genocidal campaign on Gaza. And earlier, we checked in with our Ramallah correspondent, Mona Candil, about the latest with respect to Israeli raids on cities and villages in the West Bank and the mass abduction of Palestinians.
The Israeli troops also stormed the village of Turmus Aya, north Ramallah. They have raided the village of Yatta in Al-Khalil, southern the occupied West Bank, as well as the refugee camp of Aida in Beit Lahem, and detained a number of Palestinians from these areas. In Tulkarem, the Israeli forces stormed Tulkarem, stormed a number of villages there, and exchange of fire have taken place between members of the resistance groups and the Israeli forces in Tulkarem areas. At least one Palestinian child was wounded during a military operation in the village of the Nabi in Turkerim. The Israeli forces had also carried out an operation and detained a number of Palestinians in the village of Jain Safut in Qalqilia. And this comes while the Palestinians continue to face strict measures at the military checkpoints, and people are being detained at military checkpoints not only during the military operations to the Palestinian villages. According to the Commission of Prisoners Affairs, the Israeli forces had arrested 25 Palestinians on Friday, and early Saturday a number of Palestinians had been detained, and this means that over 7,730 Palestinians were arrested by the Israeli forces since the 7th of October.
The U.S. and U.K. have conducted new airstrikes on Yemen as tensions are high in West Asia over Israel's genocide in Gaza. Yemen's Al Masira TV said that Washington and London struck several locations throughout the country, including suburbs of the capital, Sana'a. Supreme Political Council of Yemen has condemned the strikes. In a statement, it said U.S.-led aggression on Yemen violates international law and the country's sovereignty. It added that Yemen will respond in kind. Sana'a has also reiterated its support for Palestine as it continues operations against Israel and its allies in the Red Sea. The U.S. and U.K. Launched their first airstrikes on Yemen back in mid-January for what they called to protect international shipping lines. Yemen, though, has rejected that claim and has retaliated by targeting American and British vessels in the Red Sea. That's a wrap for your latest, everyone. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The annual Ramadan Quranic meeting, April 30th, 2019. There are some individuals among good and outstanding Egyptian Qurra who do not frequently use assimilation and whose recitation is very good. Besides, they exert considerable influence. We can cite Abdul Fattah Sha'shai as an example. As you know, he does not use assimilation, but at the same time, he is one of the best and most influential reciters. I hope that Allah, the Exalted, will bestow His mercy and forgiveness on him and on all Qurra. Therefore, I request that Qurra do not bother with assimilation. The same is true of too much repetition. This is not necessary either. Because our time is over now and Adhan is about to be said, I will only raise this point. I request that the audience observe limits when they want to applaud a reciter and when they want to say Allah, Allah. This is also another act of imitating the Arabs. As soon as a reciter of the Holy Quran begins reciting, some people constantly say Allah as if it were one of the necessary requirements after recitation. But it is not necessary to do so at all.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Sometimes you're deeply moved by someone's very beautiful and influential recitation, and you applaud them involuntarily. According to the Arab's tradition, Quranic applause is done by saying Allah, Allah. Of course, this is not particular to the Holy Quran. When someone sings an ordinary song, they say Allah, Allah. There is nothing wrong with this, but if we constantly say Allah, Allah as soon as a reciter begins reciting the Holy Quran, this is not necessary at all. I request that you yourselves advise in those meetings where you are considered as teachers and experts, participants to avoid saying Allah, Allah to excess. When a reciter recites the Holy Quran in a very beautiful and artistic way, it is all right to applaud him. However, one sees that some people say Allahu Akbar as soon as the reciter says, I seek Allah's protection from Satan, the rejected one, a Quranic phrase that is used when someone wants to begin reading the Holy Quran. I hope that God will associate all of you with the Holy Quran and that He will build your life in this world and in the hereafter by the blessedness of the Holy Quran. Greetings be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Gave me hope, oh Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost, you've guided me from all the ways that were wrong.
May 28, 2016 was no ordinary day at the Cincinnati Zoo in Ohio. Something had happened in this old zoo that became the headline of the world's news agencies in less than a few minutes.
Well, what we know is that around 4 p.m., zoo officials say they started hearing people screaming around the gorilla enclosure and then quickly sealed off the area. And this is what they saw when they came on the scene, Renee.
In fact, this incident was related to a gorilla, a 17-year-old gorilla named Harambe, who came to Cincinnati only 2 years ago. Eyewitnesses told about the unwanted entry of a 4-year-old child into Harambe's special enclosure, an enclosure that didn't seem easy to get out of. Tension rose among the visitors as Harambe approached the child. A few moments later, when he moved the boy to another part of his enclosure, tension and anxiety increased even more. 15 minutes had passed from the moment the child entered Harambe's enclosure, when the zoo officials made an important decision, firing a series of shots to put an end to that chaotic day.
The backlash after the killing of an endangered silverback gorilla named Harambe at the Cincinnati Zoo.
Tonight, a viral mix of outrage and mourning focused on this 17-year-old endangered silverback gorilla, Harambe.
Harambe lived his life in captivity, and he died through no fault of his own.
The news of this gorilla's death quickly went viral. Reporters arrived at the scene and news agencies covered it. Animal rights advocates voiced their objection and experts challenged the decision of the zoo authorities.
I need to let you know that that gorilla had no intention of hurting that child, and I don't think anybody believes that. However, that gorilla was disoriented, he was agitated, he didn't understand his strength. If you watch that video, you see how he takes that child into the corner. He's trying to get away from the commotion. The child is crying, the people are screaming. This was just a perfect storm of bad situations that ended in tragedy.
Some believe that Harambe didn't intend to harm the child, and others criticize the condition of the fences and, of course, not shooting it with a tranquilizer dart. Those who supported this decision also said that saving a human's life is more important than anything else. Whatever it was, Harambe's death brought up an old issue again. Could humans treat animals as they please? Who was right? Animal advocates or zoo officials?
So as a result, a number of social media pages have opened up using the hashtag RIP Harambe. You can see that from this Facebook page. And lots of people also very upset because these animals could easily live up to 40 years. And he was only 17. In fact, Harambe celebrated his 17th birthday just on Friday. Lots of questions about the zoo's behavior, the family's behavior, the parents in question, and whether this is the right way to tackle a situation like this.
Ancient petroglyphs prove that the relationship between humans and animals is as old as human history. A relationship that includes hunting, taming, and sometimes entertainment. It was the year 2009 when archaeologists discovered an amazing area in Egypt. The area dates back to 3500 BC, an area full of elephants' bones as well as rhinoceros, all kinds of monkeys and felidae, which was apparently built for keeping animals. This important discovery confirmed that Egyptian pharaohs were the first to build something similar to a zoo. Of course, the tradition of keeping animals existed in other parts of the world as well. Regions like Greece, Rome, Babylon, Iran, China, India, and Africa. In addition, European kings were very fond of animals. Charlemagne had received an elephant as a gift from the Abbasid caliphs. And Henry III had several lepers in his palace. In addition to these cases, European sailors also brought exotic animals as souvenirs from their exploratory journeys, animals that made the collection of kings richer and provided entertainment for them. Until the beginning of the 18th century, only kings could have their own collection of animals. But a little later, the situation changed.
If you peel it all back and you look at, say, London Zoo in 1828 and all the other zoos throughout the 19th century, they all had big animals, showy animals, colourful animals, mainly from Africa or from Asia. Typical zoo today has got exactly the same collections. They have not moved on from that.
The importance of scientific studies led to the creation of the first zoos with today's shape and form. Educating people and spreading knowledge was the goal of their establishment, and academic centers financed them. Schönbrunn Zoo, which is considered the oldest zoo in the world, is one of them. A zoo which was founded in 1752 in Vienna, Austria, to gradually be used for scientific purposes. Visiting zoos like Sean Braun was free at first, but it didn't last long. Shortly after its establishment, the visitors' interest made the owners of this zoo think of generating income. It was for this reason that scientific purposes were gradually sidelined and zoos around the world were added day by day. Newly established zoos in London, Paris, and Berlin started a tough competition. Competition in displaying more exotic species and attracting people's attention more and more. Of course, very soon, attracting the attention of visitors led to other aspects too. For people in the mid-19th century, more interesting than mammals, reptiles, and birds were aquatic animals. In fact, until then, there was not much information about the underwater world. Therefore, exhibiting aquatic animals could generate a lot of revenue. But there was also a big problem: transferring aquatic animals to land and keeping them was not an easy task. At first, a lot of attempts were made by Jean Villepreux Power and Richard Owen, but this problem was solved by someone else, English naturalist Philip Henry Goss. Goss proposed the idea of the aquarium by writing a book about the wonders of marine life. His glass cube opened a window to the unknown world, a window that could be a small branch of the magic of the sea before humans' eyes. Henry Goss's aquarium idea was immediately welcomed. It stepped beyond the boundaries of scientific studies and became popular. All of a sudden, there was a huge demand for having a home aquarium, a demand that brought a piece of the sea to the people's homes and was a source of pride for its owners. A little later on, shops related to this profession were established one by one. The construction of aquariums progressed rapidly, and larger samples of it reached zoos. Of course, in the meantime, Philip Henry Goss was depressed. Suddenly, he realized what a disaster the aquarium idea would lead to. A tragedy that was a great sorrow to him. Goss's distress was real. During the last century, aquariums' fever has harmed the pristine nature of the seas. Traders of this industry go down to the seas every day to take possession of its flora and fauna. Catching aquarium fish is so extensive that there are no accurate statistics of it. But it can be said that there are more fish than cats and dogs in the US and Britain. Nowadays, the aquarium industry has its own events, magazines, and customers. Customers who spend huge sums of money annually on their interest. But this is only one side of the story. The other side is the harm inflicted upon the marine environment. Fishermen in Southeast Asia use sodium cyanide to anesthetize fish, a dangerous and deadly substance for corals and invertebrates. In addition, a large number of fishes die in the fishing process. A strange statistic says that out of every 10 fish that are caught for aquariums, only one fish reaches its destination. A destination that is either gorgeous home aquariums or available samples in zoos. Visitors walk in these beautiful and colorful corridors, but they don't know much about the fishing process. Currently, the number of annual visits to zoos in the world has reached 600 million people. People who are willing to pay a high price to watch 2 million captive animals in these cages. A price that these unfortunate animals pay in another way.
Wildlife tourism is a massive industry, accounting for 10 to 20% of the global tourism industry. People go on vacation and pay money to either view or interact with animals. I don't think we can ignore the role that social media plays. The sheer number of people now not only posting their travel experiences but consuming others' travel experiences means that these things are spread in an instant with the click of a button. But the issue with wildlife tourism is most people have absolutely no idea of what goes on behind the scenes.
The first issue that environmental activists object to is the concept of captivity of different animal species. This captivity may save human lives, but it has a negative effect on animals. Not being free makes these creatures nervous and mentally ill, something that will lead to unusual behaviors a little later. Constant walking or sitting for long periods of time, injuring itself or other animals, or doing a repetitive, frenzied act. The limited space of the cages makes the suffering of this captivity harder and aggravates the nervous diseases. Spaces that are designed far smaller than the natural needs of these creatures.
Elephants are a notable example. In the wild, they walk up to 50 miles a day. Yet in zoos, these social and cognitively complex animals are confined in enclosed spaces where they can suffer from arthritis and joint pain. A study on African elephants showed that the average lifespan of African elephants in European zoos is less than 17 years, which is less than half the average lifespan of African elephants who are killed by poachers in the wild. And when the study looked at African elephants not affected by poaching, their average lifespan was 56 years in the wild, or more than three times as long as those kept in European zoos.
In recent years, delphinariums have been criticized more than any other complex. The colorful decorations and cheerful appearance of these centers are designed only to attract customers, the appearance behind which lies the suffering of dolphins. The problem of these aquatic animals is more than the limited space for living. They are forced to learn humans' favorite behaviors by starvation or physical punishment. They were forced to work beyond their capacity and do things that are against their nature. Dolphins are animals that need to live in groups and freely. A habitat free of limitations with food always within reach. But delphinariums keep them away from their kinds. A move that will cause both depression and fatal physical diseases such as stomach ulcers.
no whales and dolphins, you've got to give them a very extensive area. You can't really have a conventional zoo with whales and dolphins with good welfare. Elephants don't do well in zoos and shouldn't be kept in zoos, partly because of the way they're trained, because they generally have to be trained as well, and elephants are trained in using extremely harsh methods throughout the world.
But the only problem of zoos is not keeping animals from their natural living conditions. On the other hand, intentionally or unintentionally, many animals are poisoned in zoos, sometimes by the strange foods of the visitors and sometimes by rotten or inappropriate meals. They may starve for many hours on holidays. They may not receive timely and effective veterinary treatment due to illness. The saddest thing is when an accident happens in the zoo. Humans can run away from earthquakes, fires, or other incidents, but what will happen to caged animals? Another side of the animal's vulnerability is the control of their reproduction by humans. Fertility of animals at zoos is generally associated with a lot of control, and in most cases, it ends in their sterilization. Of course, the animals that survive sterilization will face a worse fate. They are forced to have babies irregularly. Babies who will soon be sold at exorbitant prices in the black market. Some estimates put the turnover of this business at $23 billion a year, a number that is largely the result of illegal and clandestine activities in official zoos. But official and well-known zoos are only part of the story.
I'm breeding more tigers than anybody in the country.
Yeah. Breeding was his whole thing. The whole idea was to keep baby tigers being born. Joe had so many animals that he sold them to a lot of these little animal parks around the country.
But if I wanted to just buy a regular baby tiger from a breeder, how much would it cost?
$2,000. Now keep in mind, it's illegal now.
Congratulations to everyone. Congratulations to everyone.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Welcome, this is Lantern. And the title of today's story is The Five Loaves. Two travelers sat together on the way of their destination to have a meal. One had five loaves of bread, the other had three. A third traveler was passing by and at the request of the two joined in the meal. The travelers cut each of the loaf of bread in three equal parts. Each of the travelers ate 8 broken pieces of the loaf. At the time of leaving, the third traveler took out 8 dirhams and gave to the first 2 men who had offered him the meal and went away. On receiving the money, the 2 travelers started quarreling as to who should have how much of the money. The 5 loaf men demanded 5 dirhams. The 3 loaf men insisted on dividing the money in 2 equal parts. The dispute was brought to Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, the caliph of the time, to be decided. Imam Ali, peace be upon him, requested the 3 loaf men to accept 3 dirhams. The 3 loaf men refused and said that he would take only 4 dirhams. At this, Imam Ali returned. You can have only 1 dirham. You have 8 loaves between yourselves. Each loaf was broken in 3 parts. Therefore, you had 24 equal parts. Your 3 loaves made 9 parts, out of which you have eaten 8 portions, leaving just 1 to the third traveler. Your friend had 5 loaves, which divided into 3 made 15 pieces. He ate 8 pieces and gave 7 pieces to the guest. At such, the guest shared 1 part from your loaves and 7 from those of your friend. So you should get 1 dirham and your friend should receive 7 dirhams.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear audience. Welcome to a new episode of Lantern from IRB English Radio. Well, in this program, we try to listen to certain religious stories and then try to talk about them and ponder about some of the important themes and lessons that we can take. And in that way, we would be able to make use of these things and lessons in our daily lives in order to reach higher status in religion and spirituality, inshallah. Well, today we want to talk about the judgments of Imam Ali alayhi salam and the way that people were astonished by his judgment. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the founder of the majority of the principles of jurisprudence and was the most brilliant Muslim personality in the field of judicature. He could solve the most complicated problems, removed ambiguity, revealed the truth, and did away with all confusions. As a result, scholars of law and judges were the first to be highly admired by the Imam and to derive from the very much information related to judging between the litigants and putting their hands on the truth. During the lifetime of the Holy Prophet wasalam, Imam Ali alayhi salam assumed the office of judicature when he was sent to Yemen. However, the Holy Prophet wasalam, did not need to put Imam Ali alayhi salam to the test with regard to his experience in this field because he was sure of that. Rather, he only supplied him with some advices concerning the etiquette of judgment. So the Holy Prophet wasalam, said to him, "When the 2 parties of a lawsuit present themselves before you, you should not issue a verdict before you listen to both of them in the same way. If you do so, it will be easy for you to issue a fair judgment." Imam Ali alayhi salam, commenting on this advice, said, "Since then, I could master the job of judgment and I have never suspected any issue." Imam Ali alayhi salam distinguished himself in the field of judgment and issuance a verdict so highly that none could ever match him. Accordingly, the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam awarded him such a superb medal that distinguished him from the other companions when he declared, "Ali alayhi salam is the most versed in the field of judgment of all of you." Well, history says that Imam Ali alayhi salam was the supreme referential authority in the field of judgment and verdicts during the reigns of the first 3 caliphs, who never violated his view in any case. More specifically, the second Khalif, Umar ibn Khattab, depended totally upon Imam Ali alayhi salam in the issue of jurisprudence and judgment that were provided before him, so much so that he declared more than once that he would have perished if Ali had not been there to save him. Okay, now let's go for a short break and we will be back very soon.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Welcome back, dear audience. You are listening to Lantern from IRB English Radio, and we are talking about the judgments of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Well, the issue of Imam Ali alayhi salam in judgment and adjudication revealed the broadness of his knowledge, his unmatched scientific faculties, and his capability to solve the most complicated issues that all judges could not solve. About the significance of the office of judge, Imam Ali alayhi salam said to Shuraih, who was a judge, "O Shuraih, you have seat in a place that none should assume except a prophet, a successor of a prophet, or otherwise a man bringing to himself wretchedness." Well, dear listeners, it seems that our time for this episode of Lantern has come to its end. I really hope that you have enjoyed this episode, and until another one, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
We are fortunate enough to follow infallible and knowledgeable imams, starting by Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib and ending with Imam Muhammadul Mahdi ajallallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif. So one good point that Shia enjoys is that we are inherited with a bunch of narrations and traditions from Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib up until Imam Mahdi. In according to the, you know, time and place situation, they have provided different gifts. So Amirul Mu'minin Ali ibn Abi Talib, when died after his demise, Shi'i scholars tried to combine and collect sayings of Ahlul Bayt. One of the Shi'i scholars, who called Sayyid Radi, collected a part of Alawi sayings. He says that, "I tried my best, but unfortunately, I couldn't collect all sayings of Ali ibn Abi Talib." It seems that he has collected 1/10 of all Alawi sayings in form of Nahjul Balagha. They are so precious in terms of oral and command of language that Sayyid Radi called Nahjul Balagha, the way of talk, the way of approach. So, Nahjul Balagha is a volume which includes 1/10 of Alawi sayings. And these 1/10, even you come up with ocean of knowledge with regard to belief system, with regard to morality and moral values, with regard to rulings, with regard to the history and lessons that we could take from history, and also with regard to life skill.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah.
ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
In Gaza, we're no longer on the brink of famine. We're in a state of famine, affecting thousands of people. The words of EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell. Hello, everyone, and welcome back. I'm Saeed Pourreza. On this program, day three of ceasefire talks in Doha between an Israeli delegation and mediators from Qatar, the U.S., and Egypt. The Qataris say they're cautiously optimistic, but a breakthrough is too early to talk about. Meanwhile, hunger has reached catastrophic levels as a result of the Israeli siege of Gaza. The World Health Organization says an increasing number of children in Gaza are on the brink of death from acute hunger. Canada joins the Netherlands, Japan, Spain, and Belgium in suspending arms sales to the genocidal Israeli regime. But several Western countries continue to supply lethal weapons to Tel Aviv, despite the enormous human toll and an imminent famine in Gaza. The bulk of those weapons, of course, supplied by the U.S., Israel's closest ally. After nearly more than 5 months of the genocidal campaign, the death toll is at least 32,000 and more than 74,000 wounded. With us for this edition of the program, in the studio, Dr. Imran Ali Panjwani. Dr. Panjwani is head of diverse legal consulting and a senior lecturer in law. And via Skype from London is Dr. Nihat Khanfar, who is also a lecturer in law and politics. Gentlemen, thank you for being here. I'd like to start with you, Dr. Panjwani, and it's become a tradition to really start with getting our guests' reflections on more than 31,000 killed, over 70,000 wounded, the scale of the death and destruction in the Gaza Strip, and of course, as I read earlier, the imminent famine that is facing the population there.
Yeah, thank you very much. I think two immediate points come to our mind. Is one is, since our last discussion, which was specifically about the ICJ ruling, there appears not to have been a follow-up there, or perhaps South Africa is trying to do that. And so there doesn't appear to be legal limits based on international law to stop the genocide, to stop the massacre. That's the first thing. So legally, the first reflection I have is, how are we putting legal pressure on Israel? And number two is, historically, I mean, this is the worst genocide since Rwanda. The death toll keeps rising. And even though we are in Ramadan and we are fasting, there doesn't appear to be any sense of humanity and decency to stop the killing and give food to people who are starving and also fasting.
And South Africa has recently asked the ICJ to do more, which is to call for a ceasefire.
Yes, exactly. But there doesn't appear to be a legal follow-up in terms of implementation of the court ruling, because they said, okay, you have this by this date to report. So, okay, what are the next legal measures? How are we going to enforce the ruling? I think these are the more fundamental questions.
Dr. Khanfar, we'll get to, of course, the core issue of the stumbling blocks to achieving a ceasefire, but can I just have your thoughts on how necessary and how urgent a cessation in violence is, especially as we heard Dr. Panjwani say earlier, during the holy month of Ramadan?
Well, we have to look at what Netanyahu thinks, as a matter of fact. We shouldn't really treat Netanyahu as a normal politician in this political world. We have to treat Netanyahu in a very unique and specific case, because he wanted to position himself to be the man that he can break all the political red lines and sending a message to all world that I am the one really that you can't expect me to stop at any of these red lines that you have promoted or you have drawn for any other politician in this world. And of course, Netanyahu in this case, because he always promoted himself to be the man of security, failing to deliver on that, he feels that he has really to do anything just to have any caption of victory. And it seems to be all what he can really do in that regard is just really killing more Palestinians and putting all his efforts to weaponize anything he can does, even challenging the American administration, Biden administration. It's coming in the same context. It is all about how Netanyahu is trying really to promote a new design of his own image, political image, in order just to